From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 26th day of April. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk about the commodity markets. We'll take a look at the Fertilizer Institute and discuss biostimulants. And then, of course, we'll talk about the weather forecast, too. In Chicago, futures for the corn were down about a nickel to 6 cents across the board. And soybeans, and they're nearby, down 9 cents. But the deferreds finished nearly unchanged on the day. Greg Johnson from TGM Total Grain Marketing now joins us to discuss the marketplace. Hi, Greg. Thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Tell me about in East Central Illinois, whether or not farmers continue to plant their crop or not.
They continue to plant beans. We think we're right around 50% done with beans here in Central Illinois. Corn probably closer to 25%. And it's not that they couldn't be planting corn if they so choose. It's just with the cold temperatures and the somewhat wet soils, not entirely wet, but it's more the cold temperatures. I think that's keeping farmers from really hitting it hard on corn. I think the theory is that the beans can withstand the cold temperatures because of the seed coatings, the seed treatments. So I think farmers are a little bit more willing to plant beans in these colder temperatures and let them, you know, wait it out. Whereas corn, they just don't want to have to plant corn a second time if they don't have to. So that's why we're seeing a little bit slower pace, not only here in Central Illinois, but statewide as well.
It's going to get harder, a lot harder next week to hold the horses on that one, I would think. Even though next week is supposed to be colder than this week has been, below average, that is, for this part of the world. What has the marketplace been watching this week in Chicago as trade has ensued?
They've been focusing south towards South America. The Brazil bean crop just continues to get bigger. They're over 92% harvested. So the estimates, I think, are very realistic. I think we have a pretty good idea what the bean crop is down there now. And they are running into tight storage situations, as you can imagine, with a big crop like that. The farmers weren't real heavily sold ahead down there, just like they aren't up here. And so a lot of grain has to be sold across the scale to get moved. And you're seeing basis levels at 19-year lows in Brazil for soybeans for this time of year. And their beans are probably $1.60 to $1.80 cheaper than U.S. beans. And so they obviously have captured most of the export market. That's why our export shares, export sales have been down the last couple of weeks. And there's even talk about the bean price being so cheap versus U.S. that it wouldn't be surprising to see actually some beans being imported into the United States from Brazil. So that seems to be where a lot of the focus is right now.
Here in the United States, the adage, of course, would be once we get about 50% done harvesting the crop, soybeans or corn, either one, there is the harvest pressure begins to come off of the marketplace. It feels like it's different coming out of Brazil because they have to truck it so far to get, and so much of it goes to the export market that it takes a little bit longer. They're 90%, 92% done, as you said, harvesting their soybeans. When do you think the harvest pressure will come out of the market?
It may come out ever so slightly here soon, but you have to remember their double crop corn comes to the market in July. So they have to move this grain in April, May, and June to make room for the big corn crop. The expected big corn crop, I should say. We don't know how big it's going to be yet, but they need to make room for the corn crop. So I think basis levels, while they could rebound from these 19-year lows, they're not going to get back to anything close to normal anytime soon. I think the whole function of the market and the basis down there is to keep the beans cheap enough to keep them moving so that they create space for the corn crop coming online in about 2 months.
So the basis has done a lot of work there. Will the futures trade down to the basis, or do you suppose futures will move higher yet?
The futures probably are independent of the basis. The basis is more of a reflection of the big crop right now. So futures price probably will be more determined by what the U.S. crop will do. We're just getting it planted, so we've got a long ways to go there. But Eventually, if we have a good crop, if you look at the private analysts' ending stocks numbers, they think corn could be closer to 1.8 billion. I've even seen some 2 billion bushel estimates, which is quite a bit higher than this year's 1.3 billion bushel ending stocks number. So that argues more for $5 corn rather than 650 corn. And then same way on soybeans, assuming we have a normal crop, assuming we get it all planted and have a normal crop, we're looking at something close to a 325 million bushel carryout instead of a 225 million bushel carryout this year. So again, that probably argues for something closer to $12 beans than the $14 to $15 beans that we've kind of gotten used to this past year.
And those numbers are all kind of what USDA has put into play, and your expectations, I suppose, for what the May WASDE, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate, the first one for the new crop, will look like.
Exactly. Those are going to be some very highly anticipated numbers. Like I say, we've seen some private analyst numbers, but this will be the first actual official numbers from the USDA based on not only trend line yields and acreage numbers that we got from the March 31 report, but also their first estimate of what demand will be, the demand side of the equation. So definitely going to be a big report for the May report, and then of course the growing season as we get as we progress there as well.
I heard through the grapevine, and we'll talk with Dale Dirkels and Jerry Goodell, I think, next week for an extra commodity week. There'll be a second one next week related to the Data Users Group meeting that took place in Kansas City last week. That there was a lot of discussion about what trend line yield for corn in the United States should be, and what NASS uses. Have you heard very many complaints about what that number is? Because at as large as it is, it seems pretty big.
Yeah, I think every year, people, I think it just comes down to an understanding of what the definition of trend line is, and then you can argue with that, and I guess I would argue with it a little bit. It seems like we start high and we can only go lower, but I think those people would tell you that that is the trend line, and so that we could go 3 to 5 bushels higher than that, or 3 to 5 bushels lower than that. Now, past experience has proven that that number tends to be the high watermark of the estimates of the range, and we tend to go lower, but maybe that's just because of the growing season and we've had issues, every year. So, but I understand, and I'm sure we'll debate whether the 181 number is an accurate trend line yield or whether it needs to come down. Since we've never grown a 180 bushel corn crop before, it's hard to think that that's a trend line yield, but I understand where they're coming up with that number.
And on the top end could be 184, on the bottom end, just in, I think their normal range could be what, 177.5 or 178 or something like that. No matter what, that's still a big number, and we'll have to deal with it as we go forward. Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Greg.
Hey, thank you, Todd.
Greg Johnson is with TGM. That's Total Grain Marketing. Up next, we'll return to Washington, D.C., and my trip last week there, where I met Corey Rosenbusch. He's the president and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute. It's a trade association working in the capital, representing the entire fertilizer supply chain, all the way from the manufacturer to the retailers, and recognizing the relatively new products now called biostimulants, and that aren't quite under the Fertilizer Institute's purview, but are offered through the Fertilizer Institute retailer clients. He wanted to start this conversation by talking a bit about them.
Well, when I'm out visiting with some of our ag retailers, including in the state of Illinois a couple of months ago, when I ask what are your biggest issues, one of the things that they speak to is the abundance of new crop nutrient technologies that are coming their way. Biostimulants, enhanced efficiency fertilizers, coatings, inhibitors, you name it. The volume is so high, it is hard for them to evaluate what they recommend to their growers and what's, forgive the language, snake oil. And so we embarked on a journey with our biostimulant council about 2 years ago to develop a standard that will help define what a biostimulant is and hopefully give confidence to retailers to do their own tests and work with their growers to see what works in their particular soils, climates, crops, etc. That standard is built around three components: efficacy, safety, and composition. We are going to roll out a certification program for biostimulants this summer. We've been field testing it and doing some pilot with a few biostimulant manufacturers. It doesn't guarantee that it works in every farm. So agronomists are still going to have to do their own trials, but it'll at least help narrow that funnel to show here are the ones that you should take serious and evaluate because they meet that kind of baseline criteria.
Oftentimes, the crop scientist on campus at the University of Illinois, other places, land grants will say, we would like to do some of this work. Have you talked about that? They will also say, we would like to do this work, but they won't give us the product, or we would like to do this work, but they won't let us talk about the product. Where do we stand on all these issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I can't speak to specifics, but I can say that part of the certification program will require a third-party lab demonstration or work. So they're going to have to work with a third party, could be university, could be private labs, etc., to prove these baseline standards. So that will be set up for sure.
If I'm a producer or farmer, what am I looking for actually to see that this certification has been met? Will there be a logo? Will there be some kind of paragraph? What is it that will tell me at least there's something that I can judge independently that this probably will work for me?
Yeah, great question. So there will be a logo that says certified biostimulant. We'll have a list of all the products that have gone through that rigor and that process on our website. Our retail, ag retail members will also have that information in front of them. But let me just be clear, farmers are still going to need to do their own trials. We're just hopefully going to make their job a little bit easier by filtering out those that aren't legitimate and really help them focus on the tools that will have an impact on their farm. And we're working with Congress right now. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges is what is the path to market? How are they regulated? So in addition to what we're doing from the private sector side, Biostimulant Act was just introduced a few weeks ago in Congress that'll, A, help clearly define what it is, but then second, how it's regulated. One of the things that we're concerned about is that it doesn't get regulated as a pesticide because it's more of a crop nutrient product than it is a pesticide that would need to go through EPA approval.
So it would... Where would it go through regulation from the government? If it's not going through EPA, does it go through FDA?
No. So fertilizer is regulated at the state level by, unfortunately, 50 different plant food control officials. So there's an organization called APFCO, the Association for Plant Food Control Officials, and they try to harmonize regulations around approval and labeling. And we work very closely with them. They've been looking at this program as well because, you know, they've set their systems up around N, P, and K, not seaweed or extracts or humic acids. And so they're not exactly sure how to regulate all this. So hopefully this will give them the tool that they can walk those products through that process as well.
Because we're here in Washington and you mentioned Congress, let's talk a little bit about fertilizer the past couple of years. They have been difficult, as farmers know, especially as it's related to nitrogen products, because so much of it has depended on what's available from Russia and Ukraine. And then there are just a lot of problems with N, P, and K in general. What kinds of things are you talking to Congress about?
Yeah, great question. So I think the one lesson we've all learned is that fertilizer is a globally traded commodity that is dependent upon global supply and demand. So if you take Russia and Belarus that have about 50% of the world's potash supply, and we saw what happened when the war broke out, that impacts farmers here. Furthermore, if you look at European nitrogen that depends on natural gas as that feedstock for ammonia production, and 60% of that natural gas used to come from Russia, they shuttered 70% of their production plant. Well, maybe a farmer in Illinois would say, well, how does that affect my price? Well, bottom line is that causes complete shift in supply chain and patterns and ultimately price, even to the point that Europe had to start importing nitrogen from the U.S. because they couldn't get it from Russia anymore and they weren't manufacturing anymore. Painting that picture for Congress has been really important as they see how sensitive we are from a global supply and demand. And on the nitrogen front, we're fortunate that we're a strong producer because we have competitive natural gas prices, which is that feedstock. Phosphate and potash, We're dependent on where God put that on the planet. And we know where a lot of it came from or is currently placed on the potash side. Fortunately, Canada's a friendly country. We get about 85% from Canada. But bottom line, in order to make the investments here in the U.S., the most important thing Congress can do is provide regulatory certainty. $3 to $4 billion to build a new nitrogen plant, companies need to know that they're going to have that certainty around permitting and what they need in place to make that kind of investment.
Thank you very much, Corey.
My pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Corey Rosenbusch is the president and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute. I spoke with him last week in Washington, D.C. Let's check the weather forecast now with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, we have a lot of ground to cover. Let's start with the hard red winter wheat growing regions in Oklahoma and Kansas. Rainfall there?
Yeah, there's some loud partying going on right now. You can probably hear it clear into the heart of the Midwest. Yeah, we've had already since yesterday, we have had 1 to 2.5 inches of rain in the northwest through central parts of Oklahoma. Actually, it goes on into the southeast part of Oklahoma. So we'll say the middle two-thirds of the state, at least an inch, and some areas upwards to 2.5. And that's so far. Southeast Colorado's had an inch or more of rain. There's a couple of spots in southwestern Kansas coming up with an inch and a couple in the Texas Panhandle as well. And this is just the first day. We do expect more rain to occur tomorrow and on Friday, although tomorrow's precipitation will be more sporadic and light, and then Friday we'll probably see another, couple tenths to 7/10 of an inch with a few 1-inch amounts in the same area from Colorado to Oklahoma and parts of the Texas Panhandle. So the areas that don't get a lot of moisture out of all this will be Nebraska and parts of northern and eastern wheat areas in Kansas, which they'll get some moisture, but just not going to get a lot. But boy, oh boy, is this a nice event. It comes pretty late, and I don't know how much improvement we're going to get out of some of the dryland fields there. But nevertheless, the stage is being set for some aggressive spring and summer planting. And that might actually give some of these farmers an opportunity to maybe get rid of the bad wheat and go for some corn or something like that. It'll be kind of interesting to see what they end up doing out there.
We will keep tabs on that one. In the northern plains into the Canadian prairies, spring, I don't know whether it's sprung yet or not there. Maybe, maybe not.
In theory it has, but in reality it has not. There's still snow on the ground across eastern North Dakota and some of the neighboring areas there in Minnesota and also in southeastern parts of Canada's prairies. It's not real heavy snow, except in a handful of counties in the interior eastern part of North Dakota. But there's still quite a bit of snow water equivalency tied up in some of that snow. And so they're still expecting a little bit more potential runoff and flooding in the Red River Valley as that does melt. But it's so cool up there right now. The temperatures aren't going to be much warmer than 40s, maybe a few 50s. They should be solidly in the 60s every afternoon at this time of the year. And nighttime lows should not be going below freezing, and they are. And so it's going to be slow. Now, further to the west, in the western part of Canada's prairies, it's actually warmer than it is in many areas in the central part of the United States. Temperatures have been getting up into the 60s in Alberta and parts of western Saskatchewan here recently. There's no snow on the ground in those areas. So the soil temperatures are going to rise quickly, and they may actually begin planting here very soon if they haven't already. The eastern part of the Canada's prairies and the areas southward into eastern North Dakota and Minnesota are probably still a good week to 10 days away from putting any seed in the ground. We have to get rid of what's left of the snow and then get rid of the excess moisture and then warm the soil. So it's going to be a while yet before we can see any kind of field work in those areas.
During the winter months, we talk about the Arctic air spilling out of Canada across the Midwest. It's cold here this week. I suppose it's supposed to be cold next week. Will we get some of that warm Canadian air, really? Is that what I said? But is it coming our way?
Well, that's what it is. It's hard to believe. But yes, we are going to see a warm up take place. Temperatures should snap around and get back into a more normal range, certainly in the second week of May. But you'll notice it already in the second half of next week. All we have to do is get rid of a trough of low pressure that'll be present this weekend into the first half of next week. And once that gets out of the way, we'll get more sunshine, and that all automatically will get the temperatures to rise rather significantly. And then we'll finally get into actually a little bit more of a normal weather pattern at the end of next week into the following week. And that will bring us some nice warming temperatures. I think a lot of producers out there are going to, you know, have one finger on the button for starting to push some seed into the ground when we get into the late weekend, early part of next week, right at the peak of the coolest conditions and in anticipation for the warmer weather coming up and the lighter precipitation bias continuing. They should make a lot of plans for aggressive field work. I wouldn't be surprised to see some impressive planting numbers between the second half of next week and maybe May 10th. We'll see what happens.
That takes care of the northern hemisphere, at least our part of the world. Any interesting places you've been watching around the rest of the globe?
Yeah, we still have a couple other little hot spots, if you want to call it that. They're not big, and they're not hugely influential on the world marketplace, but North Africa, of course, they have a lot of durum wheat there, and actually North Africa and Spain, which also produces some durum wheat, are dealing with a lot of dryness. They have not done well this year. Now, there's a lot of irrigation in Spain, so the impact is probably not as high there. But Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia have had just a real big struggle for moisture here in recent weeks. And they've moved through reproduction for some of the crop without any moisture around. So certainly there's going to be some losses in yield coming out of that area. And that's one of the reasons why the wheat market has been at least interested up until the last 2 days in wheat conditions around the world. You know, hard red winter wheat up to that point was really hurting for moisture and just had that freeze last weekend. Canada, it looks like they may be late, you know, getting into the fields and some issues there with drought still in the west. And then you add the North Africa situation into that equation along with Spain. And, you know, there's a reason for the marketplace to look at it as a tight scenario. But we are seeing relief in the U.S., but there's no relief coming up for North Africa or Spain. They'll be dry for another 10 days at least. And another area which is also wheat related, as well as a little sunseed, is parts of northern Kazakhstan and neighboring areas of Russia's eastern Newlands region. And that is an important spring wheat producing area and another place on the planet that we need to watch. They are not too dry today, but a ridge of high pressure is expected to dominate that region as we go forward through the next 10 days. Temperatures will be warmer than normal and precipitation will be minimal, so the ground will be firming up. Now, I'm not ready to make this a major issue, but it is something that we'll watch as we go into May, just making sure that they do get out of the drier, warmer scenario. There's a few folks out there who think it's going to be persistent. I'm not necessarily in that camp, at least not at this moment in time.
Hey, thanks much.
Have a great day.
You too. That's Drew Lerner. He's with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joined us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.